favorite colleagues of all time. In addition to being a great colleague, Mark was always a hell of an employee. I remember he once told me, but Tom, if I don't write, if I haven't written five stories at the end of the day, I don't think I've given my employer his due. He was probably the only journalist who's ever said anything like that, and the quacks did love him for it. We used to joke that Mark O'Neill was the reason that Jasper Becker could sit in the bureau all day writing books. And his enthusiasm really was remarkable and contagious, always incredibly generous with contacts full of ideas. When I was in the Guangzhou bureau and Mark was in Beijing, I remember him calling up once and said, "I've seen this fantastic story. There's a company in Shenzhen that's making dentures for export to Europe." It was a great story, and he'd seen it in the local press, which he reads religiously and exhaustively, and so I was expecting him to send down an article from the Chinese press on this, and I'd follow up. Then I received the article, and it was in French. And I had to tell Mark, "I don't read French," but Mark would often send you articles that were written in Japanese or you name it. His energy continues, even in his quasi-retirement since leaving the South China Morning Post. He's just finished one book, which we look forward to him talking about here today. I know he's got other books on the boil, and if it weren't for Mark, even since leaving the South China Morning Post, I don't know how they would keep their feature pages full, because you see his byline in there at least a couple times a week. So Mark, thanks very much for coming to the FCC, and keep on writing.
Anyway, it's a great pleasure to be here today. Usually I'm sitting where you're sitting, so today I'm a little bit nervous that you will be bored and go to sleep. So I will try to keep you.
You speak into that.
I will try and keep you interested. Now, today I want to talk about the Shiji Foundation, or the full name is the Taiwan Buddhist Shiji Foundation, and its charismatic founder, Master Zheng Yin. And we're very happy today to have three members of the Hong Kong branch. So I'd like us first to welcome the three members. And you will notice the three members are wearing blue and white, and this is the uniform of the foundation. So you'll see in the pictures, that is what the volunteers wear when they do their work. And I discovered since I started to write this book that even though Shiji is the biggest NGO in the Chinese world, very few people know about it other than if you live in Taiwan. So even you live in Hong Kong or mainland China or Singapore, I mean Chinese areas, most people have never heard of Shiji. And it has globally 10 million members, and it does international work in more than 50 countries. So even for me, and I've been in Asia since 1978, I also had never heard of Shiji when I got the invitation to go to visit them to discuss this book project. So this is where I went. I went to Hualien. Do you know where is Hualien? In eastern Taiwan, next to the Taroko Gorge. So this is where I went. This is the headquarters of the Shiji Foundation. And at that time, I was working for the SCMP in Shanghai. So I went from Shanghai to Hualien, and as I say, when I arrived, I had no idea. So I met Master Zheng Yin, there she is, and I met some of the nuns with whom she lives, and I met some of the volunteers who work there. And I was very impressed with them. I immediately had a feeling that they were very unusual people. And as you can see, this place is also a very impressive place. Just behind us is the mountain range that runs through the middle of Taiwan. And on the other side is the Pacific Ocean. It's a very beautiful spot. So I made two visits to Hualien, and I met her, I met the nuns, I met the volunteers, and was thinking about the book project. And then I went back to Shanghai just to continue my normal job. So I want to tell you a story that summarizes what I was doing in Shanghai. You may recall a property developer there called Zhou Zhengyi. Now, when I arrived in Shanghai, he was one of the biggest owners of land in Shanghai. And he had a plot of land called Dongkuaiba, which was right in the middle of the city, and he got it by paying bribes to the then party secretary and his brother. And he demolished nearly all the houses. But there was an outcry by the residents. So the project was frozen. So just that time, our business editor, Simon Pritchard, came to Shanghai. So I said to him, let's go look at this site, the Dongba Kwai site. So we went there. It was a Monday morning, about 10:30. And the site is very dramatic. It's like Grozny, you know, the capital of Chechnya. That is, most of the buildings are demolished. Some are still standing, and some are still occupied. So there were washing lines and, you know, underwear hanging from the washing lines. So it was a very impressive visually. So I said to Simon, who had a digital camera, I said, we've got about 2 minutes before we're arrested. So Simon was very, very good. He immediately started to take pictures. And true enough, after 2 minutes, a man came along with blue jeans and a white jacket. And he said, you two, you get off the site. So I said to him in a rather pompous way, well, my pass allows me to do reporting in Shanghai. This is not a military area. There's no sign saying we're not allowed to come here. And the man said, Mr. Aunier, you have been in China for this long and you have to ask me such a stupid question. So the man, he was a plainclothes policeman, he took us off the site. So that sort of summarized what it was like to report on property development in Shanghai. So I had to make a choice between Mr. Zhou Zhongyi, Mr. Cheng Liangyu, and the plainclothes policeman, or Master Zheng Yan, the nuns and the volunteers in Hualien. So I think you can guess what was the better choice. Now, I want to show you now just a few images to evoke how the foundation began. This is in 1967. And in the middle here is the Master Zheng Yan, who founded it in 1966, and some of her earlier supporters. These are the pictures taken in the very early years. There she is visiting a sick person in hospital. Here are some of her original disciples. And this is one of their construction sites. She's just starting to work on the construction site. So that's how it all was in the 1960s. Now, we're now 44 years later, things have greatly changed. We've got a global membership of 10 million, half of them in Taiwan, and the rest in over 40 countries. Most of them are ethnic Chinese, but the non-ethnic Chinese are increasing, including Filipinos, Indonesians, Malays, Muslims, Africans, and Caucasians. One of its main work is overseas aid. So each year, they assist 11 million people, victims of poverty, disease, floods, earthquakes. So this is, I think, Kashmir. You remember Pakistan administered Kashmir? This is, and there they are in the same uniform as our guests today. Yeah, this is also in Pakistan administered Kashmir. And this is in Iran. This is taken in a town called Bam, Bam, where there was a very serious earthquake, and they built a school in Bam. So this is the opening of the school. Now, the foundation is extremely well-funded. The average income is $300 million.
For when you wander.
Okay. Last year, no, 2008, the income was $314 million. This is a very substantial amount of money. So how do they get this money? Now, it's all in the form of donations. So they get the donations in many different ways. The basic one is a monthly payment from their members. It could be $100, $500, $1,000, $5,000, paid every month. They also get very big donations from executives and very wealthy individuals who give $1 million, $2 million. They also get donations in the form of land, building, property, stocks, and also in kind. If they've got a building project, a man who runs a steel mill may donate steel or concrete. And a man in southwest Taiwan, he had a tea plantation, so he donated the tea plantation to them. In 88 and 89, the founder of two semiconductor companies, he donated land and stock worth $87 million. They also have very sophisticated fundraising activities. You recall Typhoon Morakot last August, which devastated the south of Taiwan. And globally, they raised $143 million for the survivors. And actually, I took part in some of the fundraising activities here in Hong Kong. And I can tell you, in 2 days, with about 100 volunteers, we raised more than $500,000 Hong Kong dollars. The foundation also has the equivalent of Médecins Sans Frontières. It's called the Tsiji International Medical Association. They have 10,000 members. These are doctors, dentists, nurses, other medical professionals. And they go to countries with very bad medical care or no medical care or places with floods, earthquakes, and so on, and they put on free clinics. So far they've helped more than 1 million people in 32 countries. They also have Asia's largest bone marrow bank. And this is a very expensive measure project. I mean, the investment to keep this running is very, very large because the chance of finding a match for a patient is about 1 in 100,000. So when a patient wants a transplant, his details are fed into a computer and they go through the names to try and find a match. So far they have 2,150 recipients in 27 countries. And as you can see, mainland China is the biggest recipient with 909. And for those of you who worked in China, I think you can guess how the mainland press plays these stories of bone marrow transplants. You know, the same blood, the same bone marrow, people in Taiwan, people in the mainland, you know, we're all one race, we're all one country, yes. Now in Taiwan itself, Tsiji has many, many projects. So we have six hospitals. We have one university, here's a photograph of it. They have primary schools, they have secondary schools. They also have 4,500 recycling centers, which processed 118 tons of goods in 2008. Now the main people who work in these centers are retired people. So I went to several of these centers in Taiwan and I found it very interesting. The people were 70, 80 years old and they go there every day, often Saturday and Sunday. They go every day and they don't get paid. And they go to work in these centers every day. So initially the foundation did its relief work in Taiwan, and from 1991, when there were very serious floods in the Yangtze River, they started to do their mission overseas. And do you remember Cyclone Nargis 2008? And do you remember the Burmese government wouldn't allow the foreign NGOs to land? It said you can deliver goods, but you can't deliver people. Well, the foundation got in within a week. They were the first foreign NGO that was able to go to Myanmar, and they're still there. They're still building schools and housing and agricultural improvement in Myanmar. They were also the first NGO from abroad to go to the Sichuan earthquake in May 2008, and also the first to go to Aceh in northern Indonesia after the tsunami. And subsequently, they've built villages for the survivors, and the number at the moment is nearly 2,600. This picture is Sri Lanka. They've also been very active in Sri Lanka in rebuilding homes and schools and so on for the victims of the tsunami. This is a recent image. Haiti is quite a new country for them, but since the earthquake, they've been very active there and have had a presence ever since the earthquake. And I want you just to note something in this photograph. The rule when they give aid is that the aid has to be given in person to the recipient. In other words, you can't just deliver the rice and hand it to the government or hand it to the mayor of the town. It has to be in person from the city member to the victim. And the other rule is that when the city member hands over the aid, they must bow and they must thank the recipient. So this leads to some really extraordinary pictures, because the recipients largely are astonished at this and can't understand why they're doing this, because usually they are the poorest people, so they're not used to being treated in this manner. So since Cyclone Nargis, they've been active there, and they're building primary and secondary schools in Myanmar. So here's one of the, no. Sorry, this is the school before. This is where the students are studying now, and they're building a new school for them. That's right. So I think these figures give you some idea of the scale of the Tsuji Foundation. Now, it may not be as large in numbers as Oxfam or CARE or Médecins Sans Frontières, but in the Chinese context, it's the biggest. The biggest in terms of numbers and the biggest in terms of global reach. And I think this is maybe its most significant contribution to China and Chinese civilization, because the phrase that Master Zhenyan uses is da'ai, big love, great love. This means that we give aid to everybody. We give aid to Africans, Burmese, Indonesians, to everybody. Whereas traditionally in Chinese culture, you help your family members, the members of your clan, the members of your village, the members of your town, you know, your people, you help them. But you don't go and help foreigners. So Tsuji has changed this and operates in a universal manner. So when I finish my talk, we'll watch Dai Tai, the television channel, for a few minutes, so you can see that. Now, Tsuji has 10 million members in the world, of whom 2 million are volunteers. That means they donate their time without pay to work on the projects of the foundation. The number of full-time staff is very small, only about 800. So when the volunteers go to earthquake zone or a flood zone, they pay for their own airfare, they pay for their own hotel bill, they pay for their own food. It's all from their own pocket. And this is quite different from the big charities in the West, where they collect money and then they use professional staff to do this kind of work. They don't use unpaid staff. So in the beginning, I couldn't really understand this. And so everyone I interviewed, I asked them, what is the idea of doing this? And this is the phrase they use. Jiao fu ji ping, you know, educate the rich to help the poor. Because they see the donation as a benefit to both parties. the victim of the earthquake receives rice or clothing or blankets and help them at a difficult moment. But the donor, the volunteer who's giving the aid, he receives a kind of enlightenment because he sees firsthand the plight of the recipient. And he too, he has troubles at home. He has arguments with his wife. His son doesn't study well at school. He's behind in his mortgage payments, and so on and so on. But by comparison to the situation of the earthquake victim, his troubles are quite minor. So they have people queuing up to go on these missions. They have many people, more people who want to go than they have places. So it is obviously an experience that people like to have and to repeat. Now, for me as a journalist, the best part of this book was that I spent my time interviewing foundation members. So I interviewed dozens of them, and they all want to explain why it is they became involved in Suu Kyi and what it means to them. So I ended up actually writing 180,000 words, and then Wiley said, we only want 90,000. So I had to cut it in half, and I had to cut out a lot of people, which was very painful to do. So I want to give you just one or two examples of the people I interviewed. Now, this is a man called Mr. Xie Qinggui, and he went to the law school of National Taiwan University, which is like the top faculty in Taiwan. And he went to work for Merrill Lynch Wealth Management Division and became very wealthy. And he would have a very good career in Merrill Lynch. But when he was 35, he had a kind of moment of enlightenment, and he decided to give up working for Merrill Lynch. And he works full-time now for the foundation, and he is in their international aid division. So he spends his life going to Guatemala or Paraguay or Indonesia, places that have been struck by disasters. And he stays there for a long time. He went, for example, to El Salvador in 2001 when they had a terrible earthquake. He stayed there for 2 months. He told me that he carries his passport and an envelope full of US dollars in his pocket all the time, so he can go to Taipei Airport at a moment's notice and to fly off. He also decided not to get married. He's had many offers of marriage because he's a very attractive and intelligent man, but he decided that as he's going to spend his life abroad, it wouldn't be fair on any future wife. So he had many stories to tell me, but one of them, which I want to relate today, is when they went to North Korea. Now, as you can imagine, it's very hard to deliver aid to North Korea. Especially, it's hard to do it in the way they want, which is you individually give the aid to the North Korean villager. You don't give it to the government. So finally, after 18 months of negotiations, they persuaded them to agree to this. So he and 50 other volunteers went to this village in North Korea, and they delivered the aid. And I think you can imagine for the North Korean villagers, it was a really astonishing and unbelievable experience. So they became extremely emotional, and they hugged the volunteers, and they started to dance. And this affected Mr. Xie very much, this experience. And so I just leave you with the question, is it better to have donated this aid, or would it be better for him to be in Taiwan trading currency futures and making another million? Now, as part of the book, I had the possibility to visit different countries where the foundation is active. And I want to tell you about the one which was the most extraordinary, which is South Africa. And it's extraordinary because it's about as far as you can go from China and Taiwan. As you know, it's very sparsely populated. It has a very wide diversity of races, languages, and history, and it's a very Christian country. And I remember soon after I arrived, I met a black man, and he said, when you whites arrived here, we had the land and you had the Bible. And now you have the land and we have the Bible. So when I went to When I went to South Africa, we went to Durban, and we met this man here called Mr. Michael Pan. Now, Michael emigrated to South Africa from Taiwan in 1990, and he was in the computer business. And that was still the apartheid era. It was the era of trade sanctions against South Africa. So many foreign companies didn't do business with South Africa. And for him, this was a great business opportunity. He imported lots of computers into Taiwan, into South Africa. He made a 20% profit on every sale. And in 3 years, he was an extremely wealthy man. He bought a huge, big house with a garden and a swimming pool and lots of servants. But he also, like Mr. Xie, he had a kind of moment of revelation and decided that this wasn't what he should do the rest of his life. And if you live in South Africa, you see around you poverty and social misery of a very extreme form. So he stopped importing the computers, and he started to set up the foundation in South Africa. And he's been very successful. They now have 4,000 volunteers in South Africa. And as you can see, most of them are ladies, most of them are black, and most of them are Zulu. So this is what Michael does. He lives in Durban, and he coordinates the work of these Zulu ladies. Now, this lady, Gladys Nema, she's the most famous of these volunteers in Durban. And as a journalist, I got the best interview from her because she spoke in an extremely eloquent manner. Now, like many of the volunteers, she is a victim of the AIDS epidemic. As you know, in KwaZulu-Natal, the AIDS epidemic is the worst in the entire world. So many families have lost several of their members, and it's the case in her own family. So I asked her why she joined the Tsuji Foundation. So this was her answer. She said, when I was at the bottom, that is when I was in, my family members had gone because of AIDS, it was Tsuji that saved me. Master Zheng Yan sent us these messages. And then she said this quote, which I think is a very, very powerful quote. She is quite a devout Christian, but she said, when God comes to take his people home, I would prefer not to go to heaven, but go to Hualien, which is where Tsuji is based. So she and the other members in South Africa have accepted the Tsuji ideas. And it's very important for them because this is, it's not a Chinese country, it's not a Buddhist country, it has no overlap at all with China or Taiwan. But the foundation has been able to take root there. So this is very important for the foundation's future. Anyway, I could talk a lot longer, but I should stop there. But can we just have 1 or 2 minutes to see the television station? Kema? So this is the Dai Tai, the Great Love Channel, which you can see in Hong Kong. It's 549 under the Now system. Now, as I say, they have 6 hospitals, so they have many programs relating to medical matters. So they're describing the work in the Taiwan hospital. And they're describing the work of the volunteers and what they do in the hospitals. Okay. Just go on. Go on. Okay.
Mark, thanks very much. We can turn off the Tsuji TV. And we do have about 15 minutes for Q&A. Let me start by asking, you obviously the foundation does a lot of work in China, and this is a country where the government is very suspicious of well-organized organizations that are not the Chinese Communist Party. How does it operate there in a manner that the government doesn't find threatening? Could you describe the structure it has there? For example, is it able to recruit mainland Chinese as members?
They have a branch in Suzhou. As you know, in Suzhou, there are many Taiwan companies. So there are many Taiwan entrepreneurs who live in Suzhou. They have a bookshop in Suzhou, and they have a bookshop in Xiamen. They have in China 25,000 volunteers who are Taiwanese and mainlanders. But the foundation is very sensitive to the concerns that Tom has mentioned. Master Zheng Yan, she never speaks about politics. Her members are not allowed to take part in protests or political demonstrations. And over the course of 19 years, the foundation has managed to win the trust of the Chinese government. So in February 2008, they were allowed to set up a foundation of their own in China. And this is the first non-mainland NGO which has been able to set up a foundation. So they have a lot of projects in China, but they are very careful to work within the constraints that are imposed by the government.
Ernst.
Ernst Derb, Finanz und Wirtschaft. As you just pointed out, the foundation, it gives itself unpolitical. But you also have pointed out, and you speak, it's a very rich organization. It controls TV station, teaching institutions. As well, before elections, usually people do high office, they will always make a pilgrimage to Master Cheng Yan. When you ask people over the ocean how decisions are made within that organization, people usually evade. The master is surrounded by a lot of, herself a very strong, powerful personality. She's surrounded by a lot of very strong and powerful men, as the one, his former Merrill Lynch manager. But it's not clear how the decision-making process is going. Can you explain a little bit how this works, like a bit more transparent, bring a lot of transparency in it?
Well, I think you have analyzed it very well. She is the dominant figure. She is the one who will take the final decision or will decide we need to move in a certain country. You know, if there's a disaster, she will say, what can we do there? But I think after she's said that, I think there is a process of consultation. And as you say, they are equipped with very smart people, very intelligent people, very well-informed people. The headquarters in Hualien is almost like a TV station. They have computers, television, video link-ups, and they will have meetings, video meetings, with their members in America, in Europe, in South America, to decide whether or not they can respond to Haiti or Chile. And on the basis of that, they will decide whether or not to move. So, yeah, yes, I think Master Zheng Yan is the key figure, but I think she does listen to what the people say, and they do consult carefully before they act.
Follow up, but if you're such a powerful organization, resourceful organization, you're apolitical by definition. What role, political role, does it play in Taiwan itself?
In Taiwan, there are four, we call the four high mountains. You know, there are four Buddhist groups. And one of them is the Four Guangshan, which is headed by Master Xingyun. Now, Master Xingyun is a political monk. He is very active politically. He's close to the Kuomintang. He travels a lot, and he likes to meet political leaders. He feels that as his role. Now, Master Zheng Yan really is the reverse. She doesn't want to meet them. If they want to visit her, that's okay. But she avoids this as much as possible because she knows that politics is poisonous. You know, as soon as you ally with one group or another, especially in the Taiwan context, which is so fractious and difficult. You know, it's a very bad thing for the future of your foundation. So she avoids it.
Question in the corner, please.
Mark, you put the group in with these four large Buddhist organizations in Taiwan, yet when you spoke, you didn't really link the organization to Buddhist practice or belief. Are there religious requirements to becoming a member, or tithing, or any restrictions or requirements in terms of when people get involved? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, having lived in China during Falun Gong, this is obviously totally different. Some kind of cult following happening here, or is it solely an NGO that's trying to help people?
Well, when she set it up, her aim was Renjian Fojiao, you know, Buddhism in society. So her aim is to act in society. So for her, Buddhism means you must leave the monastery, you must leave the temple, you must act in society. So she doesn't demand that you be a Buddhist to join. Now, many of her members are Buddhist, and they have Buddhist services, and they have Buddhist lectures and so on, but it's not a requirement. So in America, they have many members who are Christian. They have members in Jordan who are Muslim. In Indonesia, they have members who are Muslim. So the religious part of it is quite minor, and that is different to the other three, because the other three big movements in Taiwan were established by mainland monks who went through a very long training period in the mainland and then went over there in 1949. So their movements are more traditional Buddhist movements. In the religious element is much heavier, but in hers, the religious movement is much lower.
Mark, just along those lines, is Master Chung Yen in any way venerated herself as a kind of deity by her own members? And when you met her, what was it? What was she like? What was the what was that encounter like?
Well, the first time I met her, I asked for her advice. I said, I'm very happy to be doing this book. Can you give me some guidance? And she said, yes, you don't interview me. You interview, she pointed to the others, you interview the others. And when she said that, I was rather alarmed, because she's the center of this foundation. So how can you write a book about a foundation but not interview the key person? But subsequently, when I did the interviews, I found that while I didn't interview her in person, everyone I interviewed is inspired by her. So when they describe why they join and what keeps them in it and what motivates them, they refer constantly to her. So actually, you get a very good picture of her through the presentations of her members. When I finished the book, I met her. And my friend in Sichi was a little bit naughty. He didn't prepare me for it. So when you meet a Buddhist master, you can't ask them about the Premier League or whether they like noodles or rice. You know, you have to have a kind of serious question. So I was quite lost. I didn't know what to say. And at that moment, there was a man called Stan Shi. I'm sure you know him, the founder of Acer. And he was there, and he and his wife were talking to Master Chung Yen, and she was asking him about global branding, because Acer is the most successful Taiwanese global brand. So she was asking him, how did you make Acer into a global brand? So they were discussing this, and that gave me a few minutes just to compose myself. And it was just the time when Al Gore received the Nobel Peace Prize, do you remember, for his work on the environment? So in view of the work that the foundation has done, as I described, they've been doing it for 20 years now, I said to Master Zheng Yan that she should have got the Nobel Prize. If it's about environment, they should give it to her. Her contribution is much more than Al Gore's. So her answer to that was that she didn't require such a prize.
Anna.
Mark, you say that she is the center of the organization. Is there any plan for her succession, or what happens when she is no longer involved?
Yes, this was the question I had to put to all my interviewees, and I always left it till right at the end, because it's a very painful question, because the people, the members, feel very strongly about her. So it's like asking somebody, you know, how will it be when your mother dies or your father dies? So the answer to this question is that she's extremely aware of this, and it's going to happen. It may happen today, or it may happen next year or in 10 years. So she's building a system under which the foundation will run without her. So it's divided into four main missions. So the hospitals, for example, they all have professional management, they have their own budgets, they have their own staff. They run just like a very efficient private hospital. So the hospitals will continue running even if she's not there. The schools are the same, the universities are the same. They're run by professional managers, they have their own budgets, they just run like a normal normal school or university. So institutionally, everything will go on even if she's not there. But of course, the question is the spirit, the inspiration may not be there. So that's the big question mark. She's not designated a successor, and I don't think she's going to designate one. Once one of her followers asked her this question, and she said that when the Buddha was in his old age, his disciples asked him to designate a successor, saying that everybody likes to have a person to look up to. You know, that's human nature. We like to have an individual. And the Buddha said, I will not designate a successor. My teachings are my successor. That is what I leave behind, not an individual. So perhaps that is the wisdom, because perhaps you cannot pick a successor.
We have time for maybe one, possibly two questions. Are there any more from the floor? Edith.
Mark, you haven't given us much of the backstory of the founder. Could you tell us a little bit about how she came into this role?
Yes, I mean, it's written in great detail in the book, but she was born in 1937 in quite a humble family. She was adopted when she was very young. Her adopted father ran cinemas and did very well in the post-war period. And one day her father died very suddenly. And you can read it, there's a long description of this in the book. And for her, this was a traumatic experience. And she then had to try to explain how and why her father had died. He wasn't an old man. And it was this that led her onto a mission to try to understand the sort of secret of life. And it decided her to be a Buddhist, and she ran away from home, and she went to live in East Taiwan, in Hualien. And at that time, it was the poorest part of Taiwan, a very remote place. And she didn't want to join an existing order, which would be the normal thing to do. You'd go and train with an existing Buddhist order. She didn't want that. So she set up her own order, which was extremely unusual at that time. And she was a woman, which was even more unusual. And she was living in this very small temple, and three Catholic nuns came to visit her. And they thought that they could recruit her because she had a similar sort of mindset. So these three Catholic nuns, who were all Taiwanese nuns, they said to her, all you Buddhists do is just sit in the temple and speak about the suffering of mankind. You say the suffering of mankind is without end. You just sit there repeating this and reading the scriptures, you know. But we Catholics, we build hospitals, schools, orphanages, old people's homes. You know, we make a great contribution to society. So this crystallized what was in her mind. She had to set up a Buddhist organization which did similar work to what the Catholic and the Protestant churches are doing in Taiwan. So that's how she had, there was not something that happened just on that day, it was a process, but that story sort of illustrates what she was thinking. And so that's how it started as a charity organization. Charity, not religion.
Mark, as the final question, if I can reserve it for the head table, you mentioned the admiration of her her followers. Did you stray over that line yourself? Did you find yourself admiring Master Chung Yen and her work, and did was it difficult, or do you think you were able to maintain an objective view of this organization as you wrote the book on it?
I think anyone who came into contact with her and saw what they did would have to admire her and admire what they do. I think Tom's question is a polite way of saying, are you objective? I hope so, but as I say, it's hard not to be moved and changed by what you see.
You're not a card-carrying member of the foundation.
Well, I donate money. I take part in some of their activities, fundraising and visiting old people's homes. But it doesn't take up very much of my time. Perhaps in the future I'll have a revelation like some of these and do it full time, but not for the moment.
Mark, thank you very much for a really fascinating talk about this organization. As I mentioned at the outset, Mark is a man of many projects. I doubt it'll be too long before he finishes his next book, and we look forward to having him back to discuss that. I understand there's a project about your own family in the works, possibly. As always, we have our little gift for our speaker. We have an FCC sack of relief rice, and we'll present it at foundation style.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And we do have some copies of the book, and I'm very happy to sign them. And we also have magazines in Chinese and English at the table, and please take them. And as I say, we have three members from the branch in Kowloon Tong who have happily agreed to come. So if you want to ask questions from the real members rather than the fake here, here they are. Please ask them.
If you do want Mark to sign your book, please maybe come up from my left on the stage here. Thank you.